You've just landed inside Launch Street, the innovation podcast, where we interview top innovators out there shaking things up so you can innovate and differentiate
and get further faster in this crazy cluttered world.
And now, innovation thought leader
and your super fly host,
Tamara Kleinberg.
Hey, Tamara here, your host and occasional Netflix binge watcher. Do you ever get tired of all the lip service? I think that's one of my biggest pet peeves, actually, to change and lean and agile and how you're going to implement all that today, yesterday? Or at least, does it all feel like lip service? Like just another trend wave you have to ride out until the next thing leadership decides to do? Someone actually said that to me the other day. Totally feels like that sometimes. Well, that's why I wanted to talk to Jürgen Appelo, president of Agility Scales. So they're working to redefine what it means to be an agile company in a way that is less project-based and more organizationally based. I would say more long-term. And I think we all know that no matter which system you follow, the ability to be agile and to adapt as an individual, as a team, as an organization is a massive competitive advantage in today's crazy fast-paced marketplace. So pay close attention to our conversation around self-organizing teams. That totally rocked my world, by the way. And how the key is not doing what you've always done faster. In fact, he says all that is twice work to get to the same place. So get ready to think differently about your ability to be agile. Here we go. Jürgen, welcome so much to the show. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's start with, what's the one thing people would be surprised to learn about you?
Well, the first thing that comes to mind is that I published my first piece of art when I was 4 years old. And it was when my kindergarten teacher got married. And apparently she got the kids to draw cards, make drawings. And they picked my drawing to use for the wedding card that was sent to all the guests. So I still have my very first publication ever when I was 4 years old. I've drawn my teacher very large and then a very, very small husband next to her. Because apparently my teacher was important for me at that time, and then later I realized that there should be a husband somewhere in the picture as well.
Oh yeah, that other person in the photo.
And probably I thought it was very funny. So
tell me, you still have a copy of it, or have it framed, or something?
I still have it somewhere in a book. Yeah. Yeah.
What a wonderful idea! I love that idea. It's very sweet. Thank you for sharing that. That's one I have not even come close to hearing before. So congratulations on being a published artist, I guess is what you would say. You know, speaking of what we call you, you call yourself a creative networker. What does that mean?
Well, I have a bit of a tiny issue with the term knowledge worker, which has been around for a decade or more. Longer, I think, actually. Because nowadays, I think we are moving away from storing knowledge in our heads. We delegate that to computers, to AI, to systems that we pull information from. And I think nowadays in the 21st century, the focus is more and more on creativity. We have to do something with that knowledge that we can pull at any moment from the systems that are available to us. So we're moving away from being a knowledge worker to, in my opinion, a creative worker. And then I tweak the last of those two words into networker because, it's all about networks nowadays, isn't it? Not about hierarchy. So that became creative networker. I like that term. So that's how I describe myself.
You know, I want to dig in a little bit and ask you about this idea of, you know, it's really not about just being a knowledge storer or even a regurgitator, I think, of knowledge. And I think there's a big difference between information and sharing information and sharing insights. And I'm curious from your perspective, how you go from knowing that information, whether it's stored in a computer or in your brain, but taking that and actually turning into something creative and something useful. Do you have a process for that?
Well, my process would be called chaos, I suppose. I'm a creative person, or at least I try to be. It is true that information is not doesn't mean knowledge or definitely not wisdom. That is still our talent that we add on top of that. But the computers are getting smarter and smarter all the time, and they say that intelligent machines are very close. So knowledge is something that we that we delegate more and more. But then the wisdom, I hope, is still a human thing. but the way we use that information, that changes all the time, I suppose. I mean, look at how we found each other, communicated with each other in the past, and how that compares now with the smartphones that we use. That is, we have become much more creative at which in the ways that we use these systems. But I don't see any particular process, at least not in the way I do this. I just experiment. I just fly by the seat of my pants, as they say.
You know, it's funny what you're saying. I was thinking about how I've been away for a week. I've been holed up in my mountain house to write my next book. And my son, Ari, who's 9, has been using FaceTime, you know, without any boundaries, to have breakfast with me, to have lunch with me, to have dinner with me, to just tell me something. It's so wonderful. But it's so, to your point about, you know, technology doing so much and our creative use of it. You know, I was just marveling at the fact that 5 years ago, I would have had to pick up the phone, call him, hope somebody was there to answer, not be able to see him. It's just, it's amazing how things change. I want to flip gears and talk about managing. And one of the reasons I wanted to talk to you was because of this. So why do you think, teaching people, quote unquote, how to manage is outdated and irrelevant?
Well, I think in most organizations, management is still about assigning processes and tasks to people. But we realize that more and more people can figure out their own processes and tasks, and we should just give them a purpose, an objective to aim for, and then allow them to find their own way towards that goal. And that is all what agile agility is about, which is the domain where I come from, agile software development, but it applies to entire businesses. Business agility is all the rage nowadays. And hierarchies are turned into networks of self-organizing people. Management becomes leadership, where leaders simply paint a picture of the ideal outcome and then leave it to the crowd to realize that, because the information doesn't come from management anymore. Information is available for everyone. It is at our fingertips. Management is turning into something different. And I don't believe that management is going away, because we still need to figure out how to pay people, how to hire them in the first place, what the objective for the organization should be, et cetera, et cetera. I find those to be management responsibilities. But how we give all that work to that crowd of employees, that is definitely changing. And I find that fascinating. It is, a lot of it is because of the tools and technologies that we use. They make it much easier to manage in a modern way nowadays.
You said kind of three interesting, or I should actually say fascinating things that come together. You know, one is the whole thing around don't tell people how to do it, give them the purpose and the outcome and let them figure it out on their own, which to me sounds very freeing. I'm a horrible employee, but if I was, you know, it would be nice to have some freedom, right? To figure it out. Yeah. I mean, that's part of the beauty of being humans and creativity and contributing. The second thing was this hierarchy to network, of going from that traditional model to something a little more, I guess, effusive. And the third is obviously about technology and the impact it's having on and the commoditization of a lot of work. I'm curious if you can give us a real world case study. Maybe it's one of your clients or just someone you think is killing it that you would, you know, put up on that pedestal and say, here's a team that's doing it really well and bringing those things together in a way that we should all be looking at.
Well, there are many organizations that are clearly ahead of the curve. Some come to mind that are famous, such as Google and Facebook, of course, but they are the boring examples. What I find more interesting is the smaller organizations that are not known by anyone. And I just talked with a company yesterday in France, in Paris, where they've grown to 300 people in just a few years' time, and they're fully agile in terms of self-organizing teams, people setting their own goals. They use OKRs instead of KPIs, which is a more modern way of people measuring their own performance. Instead of assigning targets to other people, you set targets for yourself. basically. And they insist, the management insists that people learn during their job. They don't expect people to learn on their own time. No, they make time available for employees so that they can learn during their office hours, basically. All of those are inspiring examples of how I believe a company should be managed in the future. And I was quite quite impressed by what the CEO told me about everything that he has achieved already with his organization. And those are the jewels basically that are less famous than the Googles and the Facebooks out there, but there are lots of small companies.
And, you know, Jürgen, I don't know if you find this, but I find that, you know, Google, Facebook, Apple, they're amazing and I love them and I love their products. But I find that holding those up at the examples almost in some ways makes people's eyes glaze over because the response I get is, well, I can't be Google. Like, I don't have billions of dollars. So exactly. I'm a manufacturing company or I make hangers or I, you know, do services as a software, software as a service. So I love that you brought it down to other real world examples because I think it is proof that we can all think differently about our organizations. We don't have to be Google at all to make it possible. And in fact, I think, and tell me what you think, that it can actually be our competitive advantage in the marketplace to embody this more agile organizational culture when we're small too.
Yeah, exactly. And I have my own very small company. Just 8 people at this time, another one that I am an owner of a similar size. I try to experiment all the time with my companies that makes it fascinating to be a manager. And one thing that we do, for example, is everything is remote. We are fully remote companies. We do not have an office. People can work wherever they want. I don't care as long as they participate in the conference calls and the online meetings that we have. And that is definitely, as you say, that is a competitive advantage because I can hire anywhere in the world. It doesn't matter where someone lives. They could be in Bali. They could be in Poland. They could be in Argentina. It's fine with me. They don't have to travel to an office. They don't need to relocate. And in the beginning, it is more difficult, of course. It is more difficult to achieve a team culture, a shared identity, etc., to get the processes working. The time zone differences, of course, are a bit of an issue. But once you've solved all that, you can hire from anywhere. And the smartest people love to work for a company that says, hey, you don't have to relocate. Just figure out where you want to sit and work, and that's fine. And it adds to the diversity of the organization. If you have 8 people and they are from 7 different countries, well, what more can you do in terms of diversity? That's awesome, in my opinion.
So here's my question, because everything you're saying, I'm like, check, that sounds great. Yes, self-organizing teams, your individual kind of KPIs, not the company KPIs, like all of it. So why do so many companies and management, why do they get management and employee engagement, I think is the other level to this. Why do they get it so wrong?
Well, because companies don't change that easily. There are legacy cultures, as you could call them. Ways of working that are difficult to leave behind. I saw a picture recently from one of the large consultancy companies where they show that technologies change fastest and then individuals change fast and then companies change slowly and then government organizations change the slowest.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, are they even on the map? It's good to know.
Right. So, and that all makes a lot of sense. Individuals in their individual behaviors can change faster than companies do. I mean, look at my own behaviors of how much I have changed just because of the smartphone that I carry around in my pocket. That is astounding. The things that I have adopted in terms of new behaviors. But it is more difficult when you have a legacy culture with a large company of say 30,000 people or something with embedded routines and rituals and procedures that are hard to get rid of. It is often easier to just start from scratch, which is why startup companies often have the advantage, not the advantage of scale, but the advantage of culture.
Right. Why is the ability to be agile and actually have a culture that's agile so important for business today?
Well, it is about survival. And survival means nowadays that we have to adapt faster to the changing environment because it is a cliche, because it's true that the environment is changing faster and faster. I was doing a keynote speech at a large international bank a couple of weeks ago, and before my session, there was the CEO doing a little bit of an introduction to the employees, painting a picture of what they were faced with, and that was the large non-financial institutions such as Apple and PayPal, etc., invading their territories, and there was the young upstart banks, the mobile banks, who did not have legacy systems to take care of, so they could move a lot faster. And then they were confronted with the blockchain and Bitcoin that are basically redefining the whole concept of what a bank is. And I was standing there, I thought, oh my God, I'm so glad I'm not the CEO of the bank.
Well, that sounds like a lot of pressure.
No, indeed, that's quite amazing what they are confronted with, and this pace is just accelerating. So agility is about the nimbleness of an organization to change in new direction, and it is not just doing faster what you've already been doing, but also deciding faster that what you've been doing is not making any sense anymore. You got to do something different and then launch that as fast as possible. And that, so those changes of direction are important.
You know, launch treaters out there listening, I just want you to pause for a second about what Jürgen just said, because I think that comment that you went by kind of quickly is so important. It's not just doing what we've always done faster. It's sometimes we got to make that decision to change faster than we did in the past. Do you find that we have a tendency to just double down on what we've done? It's kind of like getting stuck in a riptide. You know, you think swimming harder and faster is going to help, but you actually have to swim sideways out of the riptide to get to safety. Is that how we operate and work too? Of, okay, if I just double down, it'll be good.
Oh yeah, there are countless of examples of that, and I think that the book The Innovator's Dilemma by Clayton Christensen nicely described that, with successful companies die because they are successful, because they have something that works. And they feel that starting something new is just cannibalizing what they're already doing that is highly profitable. So they don't try the new things that are scary and risky, etc. And I discussed that with a CEO just this week, who said 15 years ago, he was trying to convince music stores that everything is going to be online, and they didn't want to buy into that. They sold CDs, and it was profitable at that time still. He was unable to convince them to move everything to the internet. And look where they are now. I haven't seen a music store in years.
Right. And the ones that I have seen, I've seen one, and nobody was, I mean, it was, the posters were dusty and faded in the window. I mean, it was sad. I was like, oh, I think I spent my childhood here, but not anymore.
Exactly. Yeah. So probably the time at which you'd be thinking about a new direction is when you have a lot of profit from a business model. Then you have the time and luxury of the luxurious position. You are profitable. Okay, so now think what was going to happen next. What is the new thing that I should be starting now? So because this ship is going to sink at some point.
If you haven't yet, I would definitely watch The Defiant Ones on HBO about Dr. Dre and Jimmy Iovine. And what's interesting about it is they were at the top of their game in music production, you know, Black Eyed Peas, Gwen Stefani, at the same time that music was completely changing. Napster had come out, the iPod had come out, people weren't paying, CDs were going away, everything was going digital. It's at that moment, what would seem at the top of their success, that they went and started Beats. The headphones, because they understood that, you know, they're at the top of their game, but they're a big fish in a shrinking pond. So it's a great show to kind of highlight what you're saying. So let's flip it and talk about what to do, because you wrote this great book called How to Change the World. And in it, you have this change management supermodel. Can you kind of walk us through what that supermodel looks like and how we can think about implementing it?
Sure. So I thought it is all about changing behaviors in organizations, getting people to do something different. So about convincing the organization to move into a different direction. And I thought, what if I'm a systems thinker, looking at it as a system that I'm trying to change, what are the different ways of looking at it? Well, the first is, as I call it, dance with the system. We have to realize that whatever we try is going to have a reaction from the organization on me. So the influence goes in both ways. And that is very familiar for people in the agile world, do things in short cycles. A lean startup is all about that as well. Introduce small experiments, see what happens, and do things iteratively. And there's a model for that called the PDCA cycle, which is probably the oldest iterative model in the world. And there have been many others since then. It was launched by Deming and Shewhart many decades ago. And then the second way of looking at it is the individual people in the organization. They have to change at the individual level. And there's a model for that as well that is called the ADCAR, the different stages to convince a person. And we'll not go into details at this moment, but it's a fascinating model for individual change. And the third way of looking at it is the network. I referred to that before. It is people are connected in as a network, and ideas jump from one person to the other as sort of a virus, you could say, an idea virus. And there's a model for that as well. It's called the adoption curve, the rate at which ideas spread across a population. So that is an interesting model as well, where you realize that some people are innovators, they're the first ones to try something out, and then at the end you find the laggards, they will resist as long as they can, and there are groups in between that you can address individually. And last but not least, I learned that a lot of change is actually caused initiated by the environment indirectly. So if you cannot change a person directly, you could sometimes use the environment around them, their surroundings, to nudge them. There's a whole movement called behavioral economics focusing on that part. And I found another model called the Four Eyes about information and identity and infrastructure, etc. So you ignore the person, but you focus on the environment, because a person's behavior is a function of their personality and their environment. So all of that, I wrapped it together. I call this sort of a supermodel. It is descriptive. It's not so much prescriptive. So it's not a script to follow. It just describes different things that we could be thinking of while we are trying to introduce a change in the organization. Sometimes we work at the individual level. Sometimes we focus on the environment, always taking into account that you have to do things iteratively, see how the system responds. And it is a network. Things percolate across the network. They distribute those ideas.
I want to ask you about the environment, because I know that if I'm a launch leader out there listening and I'm thinking about this right now, I'm thinking to myself, oh, the next time I have that meeting with my leadership, for me, it would be my board. But, you know, if I'm inside an organization, my leadership, or maybe if I'm an entrepreneur with my team, instead of doing it in the traditional conference room where I always do it, I'm going to take them to a creative cafe that has a back room or something. Is it as simple as that, as tiny little tweaks to the environment, or am I missing the boat on what you mean by environment?
Yeah, no, that's exactly what I try to mean. I often give the analogy of running, because I started running a couple of years ago, and I've always hated sports from the bottom of my heart.
Do you like running now, at least, now that you've been doing it?
What a person. But now I run quite a long runs, actually. And one thing that I learned was you have to tweak your own environment. One writer said, put your running shoes next to your bed. So the first thing that you do in the morning is you wake up and ta-da, you're in your running shoes.
Yeah.
The only thing you have to do is get out of the house. So use the environment to your advantage. And I give that example to others in organizations, for example. I say, well, if it's hard to do a reflective meeting with your team, if it is difficult to convince them, well, the starting point would be the coffee machine. You're there already with some people getting coffee. Why not initiate the change there? And use that moment when you're together for 5 minutes to discuss, is there something we could do better this week as a team? So you use the environment to your advantage where possible to initiate the change. I find that a fascinating concept.
Yeah, and I think I unfortunately right now at this moment can't recall who said it on which podcast, but we were talking about the subtle pressure of environment, and actually in a good or a bad way. So if you walk into, in fact, I'll never forget many years ago, sorry, IBM, but I walked into the IBM in upstate New York and it was just a sea of gray cubicles. And at that point, you weren't allowed to have anything personal inside your cubicle as well. I'm hoping this is 20 years ago, so I'm hoping at this point it's changed. But I remember how that just sucked the creativity out of our conversation, the innovation out of our conversation, where then I walked into, you know, another company's headquarters and it was just vibrant and lively. And that just seemed to change the conversation without us having to do anything.
Right. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. I've been in the company last year where I walked the corridors and I thought, oh, my God, how is it possible that people don't kill themselves and fling
themselves so
out the windows or whatever? I mean, it was soul suckingly depressing, that environment. And it is so much more things could be so much more fun. So the environment has a lot of impact on how people behave, and we should be very aware of that.
Yeah, and the one reason I'm narrowing in on that is because I think that that's something that we can all do immediately, a tiny little shift in our environment. We can put something up that makes us happy, you know, in our cubicle, whether that's a picture or an artifact of something or something we got on vacation. We can change where we have our meeting. To your point, I love the idea of just doing your meeting at the coffee machine. You're all there. There's something warm and familiar about it. You're all happy because you're having coffee. Why not just have your meeting there? So that's part of the reason why I was kind of reining in on that, on the environment. Can you, again, walk us through, like, give me an example of a company or a client or one element of that that you think a client has done well that we can bring into life? And maybe not environment, because we've talked a lot about that, but in the other parts of your model.
Oh, gosh. So many examples. One thing that I like is the simple concept of sending each other or giving each other thank you cards, thank you notes. It is the simplest possible thing. Many other experts, much more famous than I am, have suggested time and time again, just writing a thank you card for someone has such an effect on people. And some companies have actually formalized this with what they call a kudo box. Mm. The first one that I saw was at a company in Poland, where the CEO actually told me tongue in cheek that it was his secret spy system. Because when people wrote compliments for each other, they had actually printed cards, very nice looking cards for that. They put those cards in the box. It was called the kudos box. And then this box was emptied once per week. They made it a little ritual, and every person who had received a compliment for somebody else was allowed to pick a little present, like a box of chocolate or dinner for two or a movie ticket, whatever. They were just small presents, and the employees loved it. They loved giving each other compliments and getting compliments from others, of course. And the CEO said that this was the best idea he had ever introduced, because now he knew what good things were happening in the company that he had never heard of before. And after that, I learned about the same practice in many other organizations where they had often very different names, but this was the first time I came across it. So yeah, just one example of many.
That's such a great example. I think we're going to start doing that at LaunchStreet. I just wrote that down about doing a kudo box. The other thing, I think it goes back to what you were saying about letting the people who work with you and for you make the decisions themselves. So instead of you as the leader having to decide who does what well, you let them decide who's doing what well. And then you see what they value too by putting it in control. I mean, I have to imagine some of that though is as a leader being a little more vulnerable and willing to give up a little bit of control and let that control be in the hands of your employees, which sounds, as I say it out loud, like, why wouldn't you? But I think sometimes it's harder than people think.
Yeah, exactly. I have an example from my own startup right now, is that we have a hiring process that I have completely delegated to the team, specifically one team member, on the condition that the candidates finally that they come up with, I have to, of course, say yes or no to the ones that they all agree that they want to have on the team. So it's relatively safe for me. I won't hire anyone that I don't like, but it feels for them so empowering, so motivating to come up with the entire recruitment process. And they gamified it, called it different levels that the candidates can achieve. And we even had compliments from candidates who were rejected, who said, well, pity I'm not able to come, but I really enjoyed this recruitment process, because the team had made it so fun and interesting for the candidates. And that's all because I simply delegated and said, well, we'll make sure that even the people who will not work with us still have some good words to say. And then they made it turn out into something that is enjoyable for everyone. And I just look at the end result and say, well, yes, no, yes or no.
Yeah. Do you think that having an agile culture inherently makes you a more innovative culture and able to, you know, keep up with that change that we were talking about earlier?
Well, maybe not intrinsically, but they do go hand in hand, I suppose. It is hard to be innovative if you're not agile, and it is hard to be agile if you're not innovative. There is not a requirement, perhaps, one way or the other. But it's also the same with happiness. Yet another topic that is one of my favorites, but it's hard to be an agile organization while other people are not happy, and it's right. Hard to have one be happy while you're not being agile. So all of these there's of course significant relationships between those concepts.
I'm glad you brought that up. Talk a little bit about where happiness fits into all of this with engagement and agile and, you know, staying ahead of the curve.
Well, one thing that I noticed is that employee engagement has been a hot topic for more than a decade. I mean, one of the most popular search results, I suppose, in among corporates on Google. But that all applies to how motivated people are to do the work. And I often say that people could be highly motivated but still unhappy, and then you would have a burnout case potentially on your hands. Right? Someone works there
right.
hours, 70, 80 hours per week, but at one point they give it all up and they sit at home and they can't do anything anymore. And you don't want to end up in such a situation, obviously. The reverse is also possible, that some people are very, very happy, but they're not very engaged with the work that they do. Those could be the slackers, the loafers, where everyone thinks, what are they doing around here? They seem to be smiling. They're smiling all day long. They're not getting anything done. but they're perfectly happy with the job that they have. So, of course, you need both. You need engagement with the work that they do, but you also want them to be intrinsically happy, because it is not just about getting work done. Let's face it, work is part of our lives, a significant part of our lives. One-third, I think, of our lives we are working. So I think as human beings, we deserve to be happy. And there's an ROI argument there, because the research confirms again and again that happy people are more productive. So it makes sense to invest in the happiness of employees. That could be your profit margin that you're talking about, that extra productivity. But at the same time, from an ethical, moral perspective, I think we are obliged to think about the happiness of people, because it's such a significant chunk of their lives that Why would we expect them to be happy only in the off hours? I don't understand that.
Right. It's like you're supposed to leave your personal feelings and life at the door, suddenly right. Go spend your entire day at work, and then go open the door back up to go to your car and suddenly smile again. But right. Not at work. It makes no sense. You know, it's interesting. I love recently the whole you have to be a tortured artist to be creative or innovative has been totally debunked. And it turns out happier people contribute more. They're more creative. So there's also an ROI there to, if you're looking for new ideas and new thinking and how to not just, to what you said earlier, do what you've always been doing faster. You need new, different ideas. Happy people actually are better at creating those. So I'm going to put the link to your book in the show notes, but what's one tip from your book, Managing Happiness, that we could all do right now?
Well, there's tons of tips, of course, because such a nice
million.
Book. But the second chapter, I believe, is about personal maps. That is an experiment that I ran with one of my teams that's still going on, where we decided to create mind maps about ourselves. So you simply draw your name in the middle of a blank piece of paper, and then you start mind mapping about your hobbies, your goal in life, your family, friends, your education, whatever. Just fill the page with whatever comes to mind. And then you share that with your team. You can easily do that remotely. You just take a picture, or you do the mind mapping with a mind mapping tool online. And then you ask each other questions. So you ask a question, hey, tell me a bit more about that hobby of yours that I see over there on the left side. Or you mentioned education there. Well, what city was that? And it turns out this is a very fun way to get to know each other a little bit better. It's a great onboarding exercise, we have noticed. So on one of my teams, it is now a standard practice, standard onboarding practice. Whenever we have a new person joining the team, they want to see the personal map, the mind map of that person that they create about themselves. And then they start asking questions. And they say, you can still look at our personal maps. They're on the Google Drive, so feel free to ask any questions. And I've done the same in workshops where people got in before nine. I told them, oh, here's a blank piece of paper. Here's my personal map. Go make something similar. And for the first 10, 15 minutes after nine, we will start asking each other questions. And it turns out people love that. They immediately start making connections, of course, saying things such as, hey, you're also into science fiction and fantasy. What's your favorite author? And then, ta-da, the first connections are already made between the participants. It's a really nice exercise.
I love this idea. It's so simple. And mind mapping is, you know, ancient, yet we don't really do it for ourselves, right? We do it for our businesses, our brands. I love that you mentioned that. Thank you for sharing that. That was really cool. Before I ask you the last question, where can people go to connect with you and learn more?
Well, if they know how to spell my name, Jürgen Apollo, they will be able to find me on Google. I have jürgenapollo.com, of course. Even simpler is my blog, which is called noop.nl. That's noop.nl. Because I'm from the Netherlands, so that's the NL part. And I have a couple of companies, happymelee.com, manager30.com, agilityscales.com. So, yeah, whatever.
Awesome. we'll put it all in the show notes so people can pick where to
Great.
Go.
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Well, the last question for you is, what's one, you know, final piece of advice or thought you have for launch readers out there as they think about how to stay agile, how to outmaneuver the marketplace and kind of implement some of the things we just talked about?
Well, be weird, but not too weird.
What does that mean?
Well, I love being crazy with my ideas. I do the silliest things, such as only working with people that do not require me to sign contracts, because I hate contracts. I love working with people on basis of trust. And for some people, that's such an odd thing to do. But it works for me. I do many more silly and crazy things. But at the same time, I've also noticed if you're too weird, if you're too far out there, then you lose contact with the others that you hope that who will follow you. So when you're more of a coach or consultant, or at least you try to convince companies to change the way they work, then you have to be similar enough for them to believe in what you're doing. So some of the crazy practices that I apply with my organizations, they're totally way beyond the comfort zone for some organizations. So that has taught me that I have to be perhaps more careful in how I communicate things. You have to be similar enough to people for you to have credibility with your ideas. At the same time, it has to be innovative enough that it is just out of sight of their comfort zone, but still within their stretch zone. But if you stretch too far, things snap, and then people say, "Well, you're so crazy. It's really interesting, but we're never going to do that." And then you've lost them, basically.
I think that is great advice, particularly for all you launch readers out there who are trying to really shake things up and do it differently, is people still need an anchor to hold on to. They need something that makes them feel okay about doing it. So I think that's actually really important advice that we don't often consider. We're so busy saying, yeah, but we have to disrupt, we have to shake things up, we have to do it differently, which is all true. And you got to get people on board for the journey too. That's the part we tend to forget about.
Exactly. And sometimes that requires you to run a little bit more slowly while holding the other person's hand. That's the offer that you have to make. Yeah.
And, you know, it begs the question, would you rather be totally out there and unique in your idea, or would you rather see 50% of your idea implemented on the way to the whole thing? And that's the ego question I think we all have to ask ourselves. So, Jürgen, thank you so much for joining us. This has been absolutely enlightening. And I'm looking forward to having you back at some point.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for having me tomorrow. It was a great fun.
Hold on before you go. I got to know, did you just love the part about the personal mind maps? Me too. What a great idea for you to implement right now. I did as soon as I got off the interview. And wow, did I learn a lot about my team and how they think. It also actually helped me see their innovator archetypes, their results from our proprietary innovation personality assessment, how those results showed up in their personal lives as well as their work. I already saw it in how they brought innovation to our work at Launch Street, but to see it in their personal lives too was fascinating. It just gave me a more in-depth understanding of how to tap into their greatest strength and I think a more holistic view of who they are. And what I've kind of come to realize in my 25 years of being in business is that when we understand wholly the people we work with, we build so much more trust and collaboration and innovation. It's so great to be on a team like that. So here's what I would suggest you do. Go take our assessment on our website, go to launchstreet.com, click on assessment, link is in the show notes, and then do a personal mind map and add your innovator archetype to that mind map. And then show it to people and talk about it and have them do theirs. I think you'll find the results fascinating. All right, Tamara out.
Thanks for hanging out with us inside Launch Street. When you're ready to take your game to the next level, join the thousands of others that are upping their innovation edge on GoToLaunchStreet.com, the top online education resource and community platform for innovators looking to use innovation to get measurable results. GoToLaunchStreet.com.